Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Aaron Newcomb joins me. We're going to be talking about Scalar, the software that manages your applications in the cloud so you don't have to stay on it on top of it all the time. It'll do it for you. You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Aaron Newcomb, episode 217, recorded July 11th, 2012. Scalar. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, libre, open-source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at StoneAge.com, bringing you each week, or as often as I can get to it, the big projects, the small projects, projects you may not have heard of at all, projects you might be ultimately familiar with, but want to know what's happening behind the scenes. It's such a privilege here to be able to do this week after week and get to see some really, really cool things going on. I'm always joined by a co-host this week, no exception to that, Aaron Newcomb. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks. Glad to be here.
Cool. That's a slightly different background there. What's going on?
Yeah, I'm decided to stay at home this time instead of coming in. This is an earlier time if you're watching the live show, or if you're not, just so you know, we're taping this a little bit. Taping? Do we tape anymore? I don't know.
I say
we're
taping.
We're recording this early, earlier than usual. It was 9:30. Now it's 8:30. I don't have to bring the kids in since it's summertime, so there's no reason for me to get up. In fact, I was at the Brick House last night till 10 o'clock. I was on All About Android last night, and then right after that was NSFW with Brian Brushwood, and he's like, hey, you want to come on? So Jason Howell and I came on and had a few beers and ended up being there till about 10 o'clock joking around with those guys. So if you want to hear me I don't know how to put this, dictating some questionable content like a woman, then you'll want to check out Not Safe for Work or NSFW, that should be out on the TWiT network, so go check that out.
It's too early for me even make a funny joke about that, so I'm just going to let that sit. Did you want to talk about the Raspberry Pi?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Raspberry Pi has been in the news. I finally got mine 2 or 3 weeks ago, and here it is right here. Let's see if the camera will focus in on this. Down, there we go. So that's the Raspberry Pi. It's just a little bit bigger than a credit card. And I've been hacking away at this thing probably too much, according to my wife, late night hacking sessions here. And it's really cool because it actually has a SD card on the back here that plugs right in. And the great thing about that is there's a lot of different distributions that are supporting Raspberry Pi now. It's an ARM-based machine, but it has everything you need on it. It has an HDMI port. It's powered wonderfully by USB. That gets a little tricky because you can't plug a lot of demanding peripherals into it. But the fact that it's powered by USB means that you could actually run this off of, I think, 4 AA batteries if you wanted to. It's got an Ethernet port. It's got 2 USB ports, audio out. But this SD card is really nice because it means that you can try all those different versions of all the various operating systems that support this just by simply powering it off, taking the SD card out, putting in a different SD card with something else on it, and you boot it back up and you're running, you know, something different. There's flavors of Debian and Fedora that are available for this. Those are the ones I've been using mostly. And there's even a couple of builds of XBMC, which I've been playing around too, that lets you, you know, basically run, you know, full 1080p streaming out to a HDMI compatible monitor, a TV or something. So wow. I've been having a lot of fun with it, and I just wanted to bring it up on the show in case people are wondering. It's $35 and plus shipping. So I mean, it's really incredible what they've been able to pack into this little package. So I just wanted to mention that. If you want to follow, you know, what I'm doing with the Raspberry Pi, I've got a couple of projects that I'm working on right now. You can, I generally talk about those over on Google Plus. So, but I'd love to hear what other people are doing with their Raspberry Pis too. So let me know. Follow me on Google Plus and then share what you're doing with your Raspberry Pi if you're working with one.
Very good. So now we have both Floss Weekly and Pie Weekly. Good deal. All right. All right. But this is Floss Weekly, and the relevance there was that obviously it's running open source software and doing a very good job of that, and it's really popular in the geek and maker community right now. It's just really nice. We do have some guests today. It's not just about us and hanging out. We have Sebastian Stadel, I hope I pronounced that right, and Julian Rielon, who are going to be speaking to us about Scalar, S-C-A-L-R. There's no second A in there. It's like all the traditional geeky things that drop the second, the next to last letter. Scalar, from what I can see on the website, is a set of management software to be able to automatically scale your cloud website, your cloud application on things like EC2 and some other hosting services as well. And so automatically, add new units as your application gets busier and busier. Automatically take care of failed units by having some sort of checking system to make sure that's up and running and replacing it with things that have to be replaced. Even automatically like migrating your MySQL slave to become a master when the master goes away, which I think is all kind of amazing stuff. If this actually does everything the website says it does, this is going to be some pretty amazing software. I want to make sure more people know about this if it's really going to be that way. I'm sure it is. Aaron, did you get a chance to take a look at this?
Just briefly, it's worth mentioning I do mostly work with storage in my day job, but that crosses over into cloud and virtualization quite a bit. I've heard of Scalar, just kind of in the community, the cloud community, so to speak, but I haven't really had a chance to check it out. So I don't know a whole lot about it. So I'm really curious to find out how they accomplish all these amazing feats that they seem to be able to do.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, leaps tall buildings in a single bound and stops bullets and stuff. So sounds like a lot of fun, and their website's a lot of fun, too. So go check that out as well. So let's go ahead and bring on our guest, Sebastian Stadel. I'm sorry. Tell me how you pronounce your name. Welcome to the show.
Stadel. Sebastian Stadel. Hey, how's it going, everyone?
Very good. Very good. Hey, where are you speaking to us from?
I'm speaking from actually San Francisco. I'm looking right outside the window here, and it's a beautiful blue sky, and I have a view over the bay here. And it looks like there's a lot of traffic on Bay Bridge. So,
very good. So, your traffic report for the morning. That's great. Choppers saying no traffic. All right, great. And also, let's bring on our other guest, Julian Rielon. How's that? Is that close?
It's perfect.
Wow. Sometimes I nail it. Sometimes I get it right. Sometimes I completely butcher it. So let's start with Sebastian. Sebastian, I gave an overview of at least what I've been able to deduce what Scalar's about at the opening of the show, but let's hear it right from the horse's mouth. Is that not offensive? I guess we'll try that.
So Scalar is an open source project. It's open source cloud management. Basically what that means is that it's a tool to help you manage cloud resources. As your enterprise and as your company grows. So helping you scale your servers, helping you bring automation, help you run backups, helping you define permissions and share activity and tracking changes on your infrastructure in the cloud between your different users.
Well, that sounds like it does everything. I guess we're done. So there's a lot of components to this. So why don't you lay out what it is actually doing and what sort of features it's offering?
So let me give a few examples. Let's say that you're running some infrastructure and suddenly you have a spike in load. What you traditionally do is you go to the Amazon console and you'd fire up some more instances. And when those instances are online, you'd configure them to work together. With Scalar, you can do this automatically by assigning a bunch of scripts to different lifecycle events so that you can automate the process of bringing new capacity. Another example would be, let's say Julian here is fires up a server farm, so a farm of compute servers, and he needs to make a certain change to it, maybe like change in the JSON file, and he goes ahead and does that. But there's no way for me to know that he's made those changes. So basically, Scalar allows you to just like in source code, when you're programming, you can see what other people's code has been. In Scalar, it allows you to track changes so that you know what everybody on your team is working on, specifically infrastructure.
And so what's your relationship with the project?
I founded it in 2008, along with Igor Savchenko, which is my co-founder. And we've been working on it as an open source project for 4 years, and we incorporated it last year as a startup.
And what were you doing at that time that you saw that you needed some new solution to this problem?
Actually, I was back in college at the time, so it worked out pretty nicely.
So what you needed was cash.
So the backstory is back, I think it was 2002, back when Slashdot was actually a very big geeky, go-to place. And I was wondering, I was cash strapped and I needed to buy a new hard drive. And I didn't know what size hard drive to get. So I wrote a series of algorithms to determine what the ideal replacement hard drive was to be. And it turns out that the ideal size is E2.7. So when you're getting a new hard drive, to optimize for a certain budget, it's best to get something that's 2.7 times the capacity of the hard drive you currently have, or if you're keeping the previous hard drive, 2.7 minus 1. And I found that those numbers to be quite interesting, so I submitted that as an article to Slashdot. So I put it on my little website, and then I linked to it. And then I got Slashdotted, and so much traffic came to my website that it just crashed it. And here I was dreaming of days of glory by having lots of people exposed to some of my work. I completely missed out on the opportunity because my little shared host went down. So that day I kind of swore to myself that I'll fix that problem one day for everyone. And that was many years down the road. In 2007, that was basically how we got the idea that we could do this.
Wow, cool. Julian, just to bring you back in the conversation, what's your relationship with the project and how did you get started?
Hey, I joined in January. So I basically came to San Francisco for my beloved France to move the business and to help Sébastien getting forward with the business development. So we started working on a few projects. We recently sponsored conference. We work with a few partners around there, like Datadog, Japanese partner too. So we are moving abroad. And I am doing sales and business development, basic stuff. We also work with documentation and that's my job as a day-to-day basis. Sorry, I'm a little bit stressed. I need to relax, I think. So my first interview. But I'm a new joiner, but I'm very impressed. I was very impressed by the project from day one, and by what Sébastien and Igor have done together. It's an awesome project, and now I'm really ambitious for Scalar, and I want to make this project better known in the valley and in the world.
Yeah. So
I was about to add that in January, absolutely no technical knowledge, and basically in 6 months managed to ramp up completely on latest cloud technologies, cloud architectures, and things like that. So I've been really impressed.
Yeah, HTML. I knew some HTML.
I think it's great that you guys are, scratching your own itch, and that's kind of how this thing started. I'm kind of curious, and I don't want to get too down into the weeds and the technical stuff, but I'm just kind of curious if you could talk a little bit more about how the software works, especially the auto scaling and failover. Maybe we'll take auto scaling first. I mean, how in the world do you guys actually manage to Is it based on demand? I mean, can you anticipate, like, for example, you mentioned that when you first started out, you got Slashdotted. Is there a way to accommodate that sort of traffic and auto start up new instances?
Well, I think the best way of seeing it is kind of what you see every day in a supermarket. Let's say you go to a supermarket and it's like maybe 6-10 p.m., so there's lots of people. And what happens is there's lots of people in line. So the manager of the supermarket kind of observes that there's lots of people in line. And he's going to call up some people to open up new cash registers. And then the people like automatically go to whatever line is the shortest. So Scalyr does something that would be close to the manager in this example. We monitor all these different resources, like we monitor EBS speed, we monitor CPU usage, RAM usage, and a bunch of metrics like that. And when we detect that they're ramping up and going above certain user-defined thresholds, we decide that it's time to add or remove capacity. And then once those instances are launched, then there's still a whole bunch of stuff that needs to be done before they're actually useful. So, like, you don't want to just spin up a new MySQL server. You need to make sure that that new MySQL server replicates data from a master. You need to make sure that the new application server is registered with a load balancer. There's a bunch of stuff you need to do in configuration post-launch. So Scalyr helps with that whole lifecycle event where you're taking an instance, you're spinning it up, you're configuring it to work with the cluster, and then when it's time to scale down, you first deregister it with the load balancer, then you take it offline. And it's very important to make sure that you have that workflow that's properly done. So you don't end up removing servers before the rest of the system knows that they've been removed.
Right. I mean, obviously, yeah, you don't want to create a panic somewhere, in your system. This node just went away. I guess I'll go take a nap here.
Yeah. You need to be careful that you're orchestrating all these changes correctly. Especially right. If you still have users that are maybe let's say your user sessions are stored in not in like a Memcache server, but let's say they're stored directly in Apache. What happens is if you terminate that Apache server when you're downscaling, then all the users that were logged in and directed to that particular Apache instance will be logged out and will have to log back in. So what you might want to do is you might want to tell your load balancer that you are eventually going to stop that instance, so it should stop sending new connections to that Apache instance. And then after a while, people naturally log off. And the user count number of sessions on that Apache instance kind of goes maybe from 100 down to 50 down to 20. And then you might decide that when it's at 20, it's okay to terminate that server.
Right. That's a great example. Now, you guys work with just Amazon, correct? Or is this, do you guys work with more services?
We initially only started with, you're right. We initially only started with Amazon because they basically were the first ones to the game, and they're the ones with at the moment the public cloud that's both most featureful and most stable. But then we added support for Rackspace Cloud, and then we added support for a bunch of private clouds like CloudStack, OpenStack, Eucalyptus, and Nimbula. And those allow big corporations like Samsung, which is one of our customers, to run their applications parts in their own data centers in Korea and part in the Amazon cloud, depending on where the workloads should, where it makes sense. So, for example, batch processing, which typically takes maybe 1-2 hours, but requires hundreds, if not thousands, of servers, that's very well suited for a public cloud, like on Amazon, because those 1,000 servers that you need, they would otherwise be unutilized if it's in their own data centers. Whereas in Amazon, once that batch process is finished, those resources can be freed up and used by and then sold by Amazon to other customers. But consistent workloads like intranets, internal wikis, and things like that, those have security requirements and consistent capacity requirements that make it very convenient to run that in a data center. If that data center, in this case, is in Korea, right next to their users, the users also get lower latency and faster bandwidth. So we added support for Amazon at first, and then these private clouds, so that you can run workloads where it makes sense.
You know, it's interesting. We're just reading your website just before we started taping here, and I was amused by it. You guys have a really great sense of humor. I just wanted to let you know that. Your website's amazingly cool. And as I was going through this and watching a little video and going through that comic that kind of lays it all out too, which I thought was pretty clever, I'm seeing that you have different options. Like, you provide the service of just, I come to you and I subscribe directly through you, and you provide the computer resources behind the scenes, versus you also helping me set it up in my enterprise versus even just having an open source solution where I just manage it on myself by myself. Can you speak a little bit to that?
Yeah, so we're open source for philosophical reasons. Like, we benefit a huge amount from open source software across, around the world, not just for the Skater project, but for all sorts of stuff that we use. Like, on my Mac here, I have CyberDuck running, which is an FTP and SFTP clients. That's open source. I'm running Chrome. I'm running Firefox. All those are great open source pieces of software. Mm-hmm. And we really believed in giving back to the community. So that's why our entire software is open source. We don't have any proprietary extensions. Everything's just open source under a very liberal Apache license. And then how we make money is by offering a hosted product. And this is basically the hosted plus open source model that's starting to become pretty popular among new startups and new companies, where you offer your product as open source download so that users have less risk in adopting your product. If they're not happy, then they can run it themselves. And they also have more freedom. So we're doing it open source for that reason. But for people's convenience, like if you want to run something yourself, you have to provision servers, you have to patch those servers regularly, you have to update the software, you have to install the software to begin with, and then you have to just watch for security bulletins and things like that to make sure your installation is secure. So that's why we offer a hosted product that is for pay. That's actually ends up being a lot less expensive to use the hosted product because you don't have all that overhead for managing stuff. So it makes it a very good value proposition for us to sell the hosted product. And that's
and also like
60% of our revenues.
Okay, and also, so the other thing I'm interested in, because of actually where I'm speaking to you from, which is a big hosting company, is there also opportunities here to, say, white label this and make Scalar the customer-facing interface for hosted products by ISPs?
Yeah, there's absolutely no legal impediments to doing that. The Apache license is very liberal. So like Media Temple would be able to take Scalar, remove the Scalar logo, put Media Temple instead, and then make it work with their cloud products. And they wouldn't have to pay us a dime. They could just run it themselves. And eventually we'd hope that if they really enjoy the product and if they're making money out of it, that they would then get a support contract with us. It's been working pretty well.
Cool. Has anybody done that yet?
There's a couple companies that have done that, but I'm not going to disclose which ones because of marketing and stuff like that, agreements.
No need to do that. I was just curious if anybody's already gone down that path. And so what I saw was a bunch of web interfaces, and that's obviously great for us humans to go typing at. But do you also have like an API so I can drive this a little more automatically?
Yeah. So basically there's two approaches for you to manage your infrastructure. Our personal belief is that it's really nice to have a beautiful user interface where when you want to configure stuff, it's all drop downs and you can get your job done very quickly, versus having to write some code or having to configure a whole bunch of bash scripts or any, God forbid, a domain specific language to do that. So we really put a lot of focus on the web interface. But then there's power users. Power users might repeatedly create new compute farms for different projects that they have or different clients that they have. And rather than going through the whole user interface over and over again, it sometimes makes sense for them to write some code that automatically provisions the clusters, automatically provisions all the different things. And that's where our API comes in, where you can use the API to basically programmatically create all your server farms, administer them, to avoid having to repeatedly do it in the user interface.
So what's the communication mechanism between the various virtual machines? Do you have some sort of a heartbeat running so you can kind of manage it all? Or does it all report back to a single instance somewhere that's managing all the other servers?
This is like a whole 30-minute conversation. So basically what we started out by doing a centralized approach, where Scalar is the one that's basically monitoring all servers for load and making all those decisions. But then we decided to change direction, and that having it centralized like that was a little bit of a single point of failure. And also there's some speed elements to the that decision. So let's say that one of your server fails. The time it takes to remediate from that is then detection time, which is the scalar polling interval, plus resolution time. And then resolution time is the addition of API call time to Amazon plus the actual process of Amazon doing provisioning capacity and doing things like that. So we found that having this centralized model, which is actually a lot of other companies and a lot of the competition does, is actually not the best way of doing it if you're optimizing for quick recovery times and high uptime. So we're changing our software right now to go from centralized to a decentralized model, where if one instance fails, it sends a signal, it sends a message to all its peers, and then its peers decide what to do based on that message. So let's say that you have a replicated MySQL cluster, like a master and then three slaves. Let's say that suddenly one of the slaves detects that it can't replicate anymore, or it's not receiving any more data from the master. It will then send a message to the other slaves and ask, hey guys, are you getting any data from the master? And then if those other slaves concur that they're not getting any data anymore, then they'll assume that the master has failed for some reason, and then they'll elect among themselves a new master, and then the other two slaves will replicate from that new master. All of that is done by direct message passing, which is much faster than if Scalar was somewhere and had to ping the master every minute, and then on one of the pings failing, it'd have to go into like high ping mode, where it would try to find out whether it's temporary or not, and then it would send a message to the slaves to reconfigure. So the mean time to resolution has gone down from about 3 to 5 minutes before to about 20 to 30 seconds now. So that's a lot less downtime, and that allows you to go from that 4.9s to 5.9 availability over low costs and affordable websites.
Yeah, that sounds great. But and just to clarify, that's something that's available now, or something you're working on that's coming in a future version?
It's already available. The reason I'm saying that it's in the works is that we have to do all this message passing. These architectural changes are done first for MySQL, then for MongoDB, and then we're in the process of doing that for across all the software that we support.
Okay, good. I wanted to talk about another feature. I've got a lot of other questions. I hope I don't hog all the time here. One of the other features I wanted to ask about was backup. You say you do automated backups. How does that work?
So it's actually very, very easy to run just backups of MySQL. But where it gets a little bit tricky is that you need to make sure that when you're running the backups that you're not locking up your tables. So what we typically do is if you have a master and a slave in MySQL, if you're taking the backup over the master, then for a very short period of time, or actually could be a long period of time if your database is quite big, for that period of time, what happens is you might lock up, or you might increase a lot the utilization and resource consumption on that MySQL master. So we run the backups off one of the slaves that we remove from the production pool for the duration of that backup, to make sure that you don't have one server that's overloaded and the other ones that aren't, which would create a bad user experience. So this orchestration of making sure that we take one of the slaves offline, make a backup from it, and then reconfigure it for it to be back online, that orchestration process is completely handled by Scalar. And then the backup itself is stored on a object storage layer like S3 for you to use later on. Where it gets even more complex and where there's a lot more orchestration required is if you have like a Mongo cluster that's sharded and replicated. And even more complex is if the storage layer beneath that is a RAID array of EBS volumes. So in those cases, we have to make a consistent snapshot over, say, 20 to 100 logical devices that's very difficult to orchestrate, and we've written a lot of logic that helps you do that in one mouse click, or even do that on a scheduled basis versus you having to spend a lot of time figuring out what the best way of doing it is and then writing scripts to make sure you don't have to do that repeatedly every time.
Wow. So that, I mean, that last part is really the key. I mean, that simple, easy automation that you guys can provide. I mean, I think that that is really key. I mean, it's one thing. I mean, I've got a server. I'm running my SQL on it. It's sitting here next to me, actually. You know, it's pretty easy for me to take backups. I can take the server offline whenever I want. When you're running a very large scale application, it gets very, very tricky to take a backup and do it in a consistent manner so that you don't have a lot of changes lingering around on the various servers. So consistency is the key. I think that's great that you make it so simple. Let me move on to a couple more quick questions, and then we'll get back to some open source stuff, I'm sure. So what operating systems do you support? Do you support all operating systems, or is it Linux only?
We added support for Windows. What was that? It was about early 2011 by customer request. But one, we've discovered two things. Is one, people often request Windows support but actually don't use it, so usage hasn't been that great. I think it represents less than 1% of the total number of servers that we manage. And then the rest is, surprisingly, over 75% of the instances we manage are of any version of Ubuntu, and the rest being CentOS. So at least in the cloud, Ubuntu and Canonical are very dominant, with the CentOS being about 1/3 of the first one. And then Red Hat, Oracle Linux, all those others, they represent a very, very small portion of the total instance counts. So while we do have support for multiple operating systems, it turns out that in the cloud, people prefer Linux. And our operations here at Scalar are entirely Linux-based. We use Debian for that.
Okay. And then what do you have any application constraints? In other words, do you only support, we mentioned MySQL, for example, do you only support that, or do you support Postgres? Do you support Apache plus other web servers? I mean, is there any kind of restrictions on what applications you're running in the cloud?
So there's I think Julian can answer that question better, but in just a nutshell, there's some software that we support out of the box, and for software that we don't support, we provide an engine for you to add your own support for it. The ones we do support in the relational databases category, there's MySQL, there's the Percona, the excellent Percona flavor of MySQL. There's Percona. And there's soon going to be Oracle as well. On the NoSQL side of things, there's Memcache, Redis, Mongo. We did some work on Cassandra. I'm not sure where that is at. There's the RabbitMQ message queue. There's, of course, application servers, Tomcat, Apache, and JBoss is in the works. And for load balancers, we have Nginx. Well, To make the point short, we have support out of the box, pre-automated, for a lot of software out there, a lot of very, very commonly used, excellent open source software.
Okay. And if I'm running something else, just let's just say I'm running, I don't even know, but let's just say I'm running something else. Does that mean I can't use Scalar, or it just means that some features won't work?
It just means that... So we have a scripting engine that provides you with building blocks. And those building blocks, we use those to build automatically scaling, automatically recovering, auto-healing systems. And we've done that for MySQL. We've done it for Postgres, for Mongo, and a bunch of other things. And then we've integrated those very deeply into the user interface so that you can backups directly from the UI so that you can track replication status and a bunch of other metrics like that. In the case where you want to have support, let's say that you want the Jedi application server. We don't have direct support for that, so you'd use the building blocks that we use for you to build your own automation for it. So you'd use different hooks that we provide for you to integrate with the load balancer, for you to integrate with your database and caching servers so that you can run this orchestration yourself.
And so what's the interface? What's the interface for that? Am I programming in a programming language, or is this some sort of a domain-specific language, or what?
We feel very strongly about letting you program in your own language. So you just specify the shebang at the very beginning, and then we'll just execute that script that you write in any language you want on the client host. So you can write a chef recipe and have that executed with Knife on the client server. You can use a Puppet module, Perl, heaven forbid, Bash, you want. So we're very agnostic on the language you use. But all the lifecycle hooks, for example, on instance has finished booting, or on instance has changed IP address, or on this other instance has completed this task, then you can, those are hooks that you can tie certain scripts to be executed on. So if you're familiar with configuration management tools, they answer the question what to do. And all these scripts that you can write in Bash and Perl and whatever, those are what to do. But Scalyr brings in the when. That scripting engine provides you when you want to do the what. So in the case where you might be building, let's say, a JD application server that you want to integrate with the load balancer, you can specify on the event a new JD application started and running, then the what would be register that new IP address with the load balancer. So the when and the what is important to be able to construct your own automation for you to build your own orchestration.
We have a question actually from the chat room. We have a live chat room that's going on while we're taping the show, and a traveler without a second E says, are they using 0MQ internally? I'm actually then curious about what kind of communication layers are you actually using?
Yeah, I believe we actually do use 0MQ, and we've been really happy with it. I don't have more details because I haven't worked on that specific piece of code. But for our requirements, 0MQ has been working very well. We don't provide 0MQ support out of the box, and that's probably something we should do at some point. But Rabbit is more popular and has been requested more often, so we started out by adding support for that.
Okay, and I noticed in absence, I don't know if that's just an oversight, but you didn't list MariaDB.
We haven't had that many requests for adding support for it. So if you wanted to use MariaDB, you just use the scripting and automation framework for you to build it yourself.
Well, I imagine since it's basically a drop-in replacement for MySQL, you could probably just start with that in terms of scripting and stuff, and then change it over.
Used it, but if it really is a drop-in replacement, like Percona is, then you just use MySQL software that we have integrated. And then you just replace MySQL with MariaDB, and you just use all the existing rules.
And so what is all this implemented in?
Great question. So initially, one of the reasons I said heaven forbid Bash is because we initially wrote all these automation scripts in Bash, mm-hmm. And that quickly became unmaintainable. So we have the system where the Scalyr itself is written in PHP, mm-hmm. and then we have a guest agent running on each of the servers that monitors load and performs actions, like remediation actions. That used to be written in Bash, and we've rewritten that in Python. Python's been working really well. That's the guest agent is what runs 0MQ and some other software that helps us provide high availability to different systems. Scalyr is PHP. For Scalyr, it's Python for the guest agent, and the PHP code that Scalyr has, basically its only job is to spit out JSON to the user interface, which is entirely JavaScript, and uses the same runtime model as Gmail and other popular Google applications.
So I could actually interface directly with the JSON layer and use that as my API then?
Yeah, correct. Although you could just, it would be simpler for you to use one of the client libraries that we've provided, and just use the RESTful API that we have.
How is this project happening? Are you you're obviously like the grand poobah, right? You're the guy that's in charge of ultimately deciding what's happening in here. But what's the governance like? I mean, who decides what features are going in the next release and where it's headed overall?
The main decider of new features is a website that we have at scalyr.uservoice.com. Mm-hmm. which is where our clients vote on new features, suggest and vote on new features. That's pretty much how we decide what to work on. And then there's strategically some initiatives that we have that we think would be valuable to surprise our customers with. So right now we have one very secret project that's in the works that I think will turn out to be absolutely awesome. And we haven't told anybody about it, and we're waiting to surprise our users with it. So feature development is basically a combination of user feedback that's completely completely egalitarian and vote-driven. And then there are secret cool things that we're working on to that we think would are potentially game changers.
And the open source components of this, are you coding in open in an open way? I mean, you have an open public repo, or is this all behind the scenes and just releases just sort of show up?
It is on GitHub, so a savvy Python programmer would be able to go to github.com/scaler/scaler and find out what those secret projects we're working on are. But so far, we haven't had any leaks, so we're good.
Cool. And how much of the code is done within your organization, and how much is actually coming from the community?
It's 100% from the Scaler employee base. Because we've found that nothing beats the quality of a full-time contributor. So the couple of patches that we've received from the community have been incorporated into Scaler. In some form or another, but the very, very large majority of the code base is done by full-time contributors that are paid by a Scaler.
I feel bad leaving Julian on the line here, but not actually saying anything. You said something earlier that Julian could elaborate on. Why don't we start with that, whatever it was, about the what you're actually supporting or something?
The list of software that we support.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was on the different, like Sebastian said, there are different types of support. So basically, if you want to use Nginx, and that's the load balancer we support out of the box, so we have a pre-made image for Nginx. And if you use Nginx in your farms and a server goes down and a new spins up, Scaler will automatically register the new server to Nginx. Mm. If you want to use a different kind of load balancer, let's say Rackspace load balancer, that's not something we are currently supporting out of the box, you will need to use a scripting engine to make the automatic connection yourself. So that's where the difference is. Some software are completely automated, and so others you have to tweak it yourself. But because Scaler is just managing server, you can obviously install anything on a server, and there is no actual limitation to this fact.
Okay, Julian, actually, we had a question from IRC that I think you could probably handle. Is there a time frame for the OpenStack support?
yes. the answer is no, because we don't comment on ETA, and actually, I have actually no idea. I can say it will be released probably this year, but it depends on. It depends on how goes the progress and what comes up as a priority project, and if what is the actual demand for this. We know we are going to support it, but I cannot give any news. Actually, on the website, you can sign up to a newsletter, and you will be notified once the support is there. It's on feature. Multi-cloud, and then you click on OpenStack and you ask us to be notified.
Okay, and I just want to comment that was from Esol, just so he gets his name mentioned in the show as well. They always like that when I do that. So yay. We've had Libvirt, whatever you call it, on the show about 15, 20 weeks ago. And one of the things that they were doing with that was it was allowing them to talk to a lot of different kinds of stack applications, different hosting systems. Would you be able to migrate some of your code so it could support something that's really generic, so that you could get them all for once without having to code it separately?
So that's one of our gripes with OpenStack is because it's like it's not really a product; it's more of a project. Mm-hmm. Instead of loosely coupled pieces of software that together form OpenStack. There's like Nova, there's Glance, there's Keystone, like volumes, and then there's Swift. All those are different pieces that you like. You need to glue together in order to be to have a fully functional OpenStack cluster. And one of the reasons that OpenStack support has been we've been postponing it for maybe 2 years now. One of the reasons for that is because it's very hard to get a cluster that supports both volumes and Swift and Keystone and supports all those together. So think about it this way. If you want to have Scalyr manage your applications on OpenStack, but there's no object storage in your cluster, then that means we can't take any backups. That means that we would offer our users a pretty crappy experience where there if something goes down, they don't have any backups to run. Or similarly, if they don't have volumes, then they don't have any persistent storage. So if things go down, then they're completely reliant on falling back to the previous backup. So it really is really important for people that are deploying OpenStack to consider deploying all those different components. And as far as I know, I haven't seen any vendor out there or any provider out there that supports all of these projects so that we could fully benefit from that. If there's somebody in the audience that has access to such a cluster, we'd be very happy to use it, and then we'd be able to add OpenStack support very quickly. But until then, we're just waiting for somebody to get all those pieces working together.
But the thing I see about OpenStack is although a lot of people have signed on to it and there's a lot of buzz around it, it still seems somewhat immature to me. It seems like we're still probably 6 months to a year before it'll kind of settle down in its external interfaces and actually, like you said, what's in the mix when you say I have OpenStack, what does that actually mean? So I understand the frustration you're feeling about that because it's just a lot of moving targets there and how do you build to that? How do you design for that? So
and similarly, first there's the Austin, then there's the Bear release. Both of those were very, very early, and they said it was early. Then they said that Cactus would be ready and usable. It turned out not to be, and there were high hopes for Diablo. When Diablo came out, it was a fairly disappointing release, and then hopes were then placed on Bear what's the latest one? Essex. Essex is actually much better. But there's still a little way to go I would consider it production worthy.
Have you looked at Open Nebula? They seem to be a lot further down the chain. I don't mean Nebula, I mean Open Nebula, which is the thing out of Europe.
I haven't looked at that at all. I think that it's going to be very hard for them to continue in this game where CloudStack and OpenStack already have very large developer mindshare. Mm-hmm. And then there's Eucalyptus that is pretty dominant in terms of number of installs. So I think it's going to be very difficult for Open Nebula to continue.
Yeah, it's unfortunate too because it was like version 2.4 or something. It was actually pretty complete and had really nice white labeling thing where you could keep nesting down and each person could resell a portion of the resources they were given by the upstream and a lot of really great features. But you know, again, it's competing against this immediate jump to OpenStack that a lot of people had a couple of years ago.
And there's actually a little backstory here that's not very well known. Is the decision when Rackspace and NASA met to form OpenStack, it was just a matter of timing that they met and decided to do this together, because Open Nebula was to be considered, and for some timing issues, they decided to just create something from scratch based off their experience with Eucalyptus instead of basing it off Open Nebula. So Open Nebula could have been Nova, from what I understand. Had the folks at Open Nebula done a better job at partnering and awareness and stuff like that.
So what else competes with you? We've had this question a couple times in the chat. And what's similar to what Scalyr is doing, and how would you contrast yourself with your competitors, if you can even call it that?
To be honest, the primary competitor that we have is people doing it yourself in DIY. Mm-hmm. And it's how to explain. So it's very easy to put together a couple of scripts that trigger new instances to be launched based on event X and Y and Z. That's very easy, and people often understand Scalyr to be just that. So they think that they might as well just create those scripts and not have to use any open source software to do it. But it turns out that managing and maintaining that and growing it is actually difficult. And we've seen that there's quite a bit of people that after an initial failure doing things themselves, if they're brave enough to admit failure, then they would move to a scaler. In terms of commercial competitors, RightScale would be a primary competitor. Though we have very different approaches to solving the same problem. An example that I often give is how we implemented RAID support versus how they implemented it. In their way of adding RAID support is they're giving you a domain-specific language called like write scripts or server templates, which is this very complicated way of writing a script that's all RAID on all your servers, like a model-based way of doing it. In Scalar, it's we hid all that behind the scenes. And we just offer you a drop-down where you can select the RAID type and then another drop-down that allows you to specify both number of volumes to be used and the size of those volumes. So it's two different ways of solving the same problem. We solve it by hiding the complexity from you and just presenting a nice interface for drop-downs. And they provide you with access to the raw code, which in our opinion has a higher... in some respects, it could be more flexible, but it has a very, very high learning curve to it.
So I want to kind of ask a little bit about the open source code that you guys let people use. I noticed, like, for example, when I look on your website, I look at the pricing. You know, there's some features there. And I also want to ask about multi-cloud support, too, so don't let me forget that. But for example, multi-cloud support, I mean, are all the features that are listed in your pricing sheet, are those available in the open source code that people can download and try?
Yeah, everything is open source, including multi-cloud, including every feature, every software that we provide. There's only one thing that's in the hosted product that's not in the open source code, and that's MineTerm, which is an SSH terminal. And that's just because it's currently the best SSH terminal there is that supports public key authentication. And that's only available on a commercial license. So with that exception, everything is open source.
Okay, cool. That's awesome. You know, we've had other, I won't mention their names, we've had other projects on that, you know, give out open source for most stuff, but then they lock down the really cool features and make people pay for those. So I think it's awesome that you guys provide both. It helps that this type of thing is complex enough that, you know, if you're doing this seriously, you probably really do want to pay someone to help you support it and use it or use the hosted services. Getting back to multi-cloud support, though, how does that work? Is that difficult or because of the nature of the software, maybe it's not a big deal?
Well, multi-cloud support was actually pretty difficult in the beginning because you have to build some sort of abstraction layer. But the most difficult part was that Amazon had all these features that allowed us to do all sorts of different automation magic, and nobody else had it. So when adding support for another cloud, we could only offer limited experiences and limited automation on these other clouds, which kind of defeated the purpose of using the cloud to begin with. So we only add a new cloud to the list of clouds that we support when that cloud is mature enough and stable enough for us to be able to provide a great experience to our users. Currently, the required pieces are elastic IPs, so reattachable IP addresses, volumes, object storage for backups, of course, compute nodes, and there's a little list somewhere on the wiki.
And just real quick, one more question, and then I'll turn it back over to Randall. As a company, did you guys get funded? Are you a funded startup? Is that how it worked, or did you guys just start and grow organically?
It's been actually completely organic. We got to cash flow profitability within 5 or 6 months of starting, and then we've been basically hiring as revenue has been growing. So it's all common stock in the company. It's a very simple structure. Our employees and founders own in total 100% of the stock, and that gives us the flexibility of deciding, hey, we want to have everything open source. Doesn't matter if we might possibly make less money from doing that, but we believe that's best for the community. So it allows us to make decisions based on what we believe is best for the product itself. And it's in the past 4 years of development, it's turned out to be pretty good. I believe we have a pretty strong product, and I'm actually quite proud of it.
Yeah, well, I noticed that. Sorry, Aaron. You said you're going to turn over to me, and
you
start talking.
You should be proud. I mean, you know, there's not too many startups that can say they. But first of all, there's not too many startups that can say they don't get. You know, they haven't really had any funding, and almost none of them are profitable in the first 6 months, let alone the first few years. So I think that's great. Kudos to you guys.
Thank you.
Indeed, indeed. What's the connection to the Ukraine? I recognize the names all sound like they're Eastern European. So is there a connection there?
Well, there's two connections, actually. There's a French connection and there's a Ukrainian connection. My engineering co-founder, Igor, is Ukrainian. And then I studied in France. So that explains the two connections there.
So how much of the development happens in San Francisco versus the Ukraine then?
Right now in San Francisco, we have our user interface development as well as technical documentation. And then we have our engineering that's in Sebastopol in the Ukraine for the guest agents as well as for some components of the Scalar core. So it's a fairly distributed model.
How do you find dealing with the time zones changes like that and being able to converse, or is it all done by email and stuff?
Well, we fly everybody, or we fly a lot of people in San Francisco. Maybe once every 6 months. Now that we can afford it, it's once every 3 months. That allows us to establish roadmap and just hang out as buddies. So, that distributed engineering is actually very, very challenging, much more so than I thought it would be. So, it requires us to gather everybody once in a while.
Do you do things like screen sharing and stuff back and forth to kind of work through issues?
No, we haven't run into an issue that couldn't be solved via actually Skype IM has been very useful to us. Mm-hmm. And then just the occasional meeting once every couple months allows us to sync up on all the difficult issues. But mostly, once we have a common roadmap and we know what we're going to be doing, it allows us to plan out stuff, and we don't actually run into complicated issues that often.
Cool. Well, we're just about out of time, so I just want to wrap up here by making sure that we covered everything you guys wanted to cover. So, Julian, we'll start with you. Is there anything that we left out that you think we should still keep talking about?
Yeah, I think we could talk about our roadmap.
Sure. Go
ahead. Like, I don't know if you heard of it, but Google Compute Engine is going to launch their new cloud. As launched actually at the Google I/O event, and it's now in a private limited beta or something like that. And mm-hmm. we are going to support it in the next weeks. So I think you need to stay tuned because we already tested it and it's really impressive performance and and management. And I think it's going to totally disrupt the industry right there. So if you are looking for a new great public cloud, that's mm-hmm. something you should take a look at it.
Very cool. Anything else?
Yeah, I can concur that Compute Engine is absolutely awesome. It's just one of the main problems that you have when you're running stuff on the Amazon cloud is that you do not get consistent performance over time. And in our trials on the Compute Engine, you do get high throughputs and high consistent throughput, which is absolutely awesome.
Well, it could just be that not very many people are using it yet, right?
Actually, there's a couple of papers that if you know Jeff Dean is like the Chuck Norris of Google. Okay. He wrote a couple of papers on how to make sure that that you have predictable network performance over in large area networks. So they've done a lot of optimizations that way. So I think they have the technical know-how to make that work.
Definitely sounds great. Anything else, Sebastian, that we left out that you want to make sure gets covered before I have to send you off?
No, but there's a fun little tidbit. The Higgs boson was the data that was obtained from the what's it called? That
Atlas?
From Atlas, yeah. Atlas actually uses Scalar. So in some tiny part, Scalar has contributed to the discovery of the Higgs boson. So I thought that was... We gave each other lots of high fives when we discovered that.
That's awesome. That is awesome. That's definitely a credit to your jewel to your crown. Well, thank you guys for both coming on the show, and I'm fascinated by this. I know where I'm going to be going right after this show. I got to go talk to some people here at Media Temple about this because it sounds like a really interesting opportunity there. So once again, thank you, Sebastian, for coming on the show.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Julian, as well.
Thank you, guys. Awesome.
Very good, very good. That was Sebastian Stadel and Julian Rialan. I probably mispronounced it after you got there. Talking to us about Scalar. Sounds fascinating. What do you think, Aaron?
Yeah, I'm with you. I think it sounds really cool. I've heard of Scalar. I knew, generally about it, but I got to say, I didn't even know that it was open source. I thought it was all proprietary software. So when I saw that they were coming on the show, I was like, really? Open source? That's cool. Because it's been getting a lot of good press, I think, in the media and stuff. So, and it's easy to see why once you hear about the type of capability that they are offering their clients. The fact that they offer everything in the open source version, I think is fantastic. They're obviously the big companies are going to pay for this. They're going to pay for the support anyway. So why not offer everything in the open source version? So if you're just getting started or you want to hack on it, you can do that. I think that's great. I think that's the way projects like this really should be run.
Well, and I liked what he said about open source contributed to this, so there was sort of a natural ethical desire to contribute back by having this be open source and not locking it down, even though that it was all built using those sorts of components. You know, it's interesting, when we brought the OpenShift guys on, I don't know if you were on that show, OpenShift?
Yeah.
Okay. I remember them talking about how they had to manually fire up EC2 instances to handle scale for a given set of applications. I'm thinking, wow, they could have just used Scalar to manage their EC2 infrastructure for their OpenShift hosted product. So maybe we'll have to call them back and say, hey, why don't you try this as well? Maybe they just didn't know about it. That's pretty cool. But I'm thinking, again, here at a hosting company, it seems obvious that this would be something that, if not just used internally to even provide as a customer-facing interface to allow you to have scalable applications and just, get it from the get-go, which sounds really, really cool. I may actually look also at the source code. I didn't get a chance before this show to kind of pull that down and see how complex the things are and what kinds of recipes they have in there and what kind of secret sauce they've actually made public, like when I'm talking about how to do the rolling backups and stuff. That all sounded really good stuff. Anything else?
Also, I wanted to echo what you said before about their website. Their website's great. I think all websites should be like this. In fact, when you click on how it works at the top, it'll actually take you to this area where you can see exactly how it works. There's a little webcast, and it says, "Quick, grab the popcorn," because you're going to be here a while. And then
this
also
is humor. It's great humor. This is all this website makes me want to use the product. That's exactly. A lot of other open source projects should look at this as a model of how to sell their software. I mean, selling in the sense of having people use it. I mean, that's a sales effort in itself. So yeah, I agree.
How many websites do you know that put a comic book as the part of their getting started guide? There's a Scalar illustrated comic book on there, and when you click on it, there's a whole comic book. That's not it, but there is a comic book there that basically walks you through. And there's a guy saying, "Oh no, the servers are down," and all this stuff. And it's hilarious, but it also gets the point across very effectively. So.
Yeah, wonderful stuff. Everybody should take that as a model for going there. Speaking of everybody else, let's talk about some upcoming guests. I'm still booking the rest of Q3, trying to get that all put in place. I'm a lot of email flying back and forth, but we do have a few confirmed people coming up really soon. Next week, of course, is OSCON, the big open source convention that's been running many, many years now. Started as the Perl conference back in the early days and sort of evolved to be all of open source and Perl just being a footnote somewhere at the bottom of the show list. Both Simon Phipps and I will be there, and we have secured a room for us to go live at 8:30 next week, 8:30 a.m. Pacific time, and hopefully we'll have some guests in there. That hopefully their coffee will kick in early enough for that show. But we will at least be hosting a live show from there and talking about what's going on. Following that, we have the Falcon programming language, which looks like a multi-paradigm programming language, open source. You can do functional programming in it. You can do Prolog style programming. You can do object-oriented programming. It sounds like a really fascinating little device there. Then the Open Bravo ERP system. This is another of those big corporate sort of buzzwordy sort of things, and we want them to come on and explain all that for us. The Twisted Python Framework, which is a Python framework that allows multiple events to happen and be able to respond to the events in a, some sort of orderly way, just added to the schedule. I'm really happy about this. We have KVM, which is the virtualizing software that almost all the rest of these technologies are all pretty much using KVM as their primary one. We have the guys actually talking about KVM coming on towards the end of third quarter. Oops, I skipped over one. Right after OSCON, we're going to get an update from the 2600 Hertz project, which is a we had them on like a year and a half ago, but they've come out with this really, really cool new software, essentially completely full-featured PBX in a box, you know, with all sorts of connections and interfaces and stuff. And you can either have them host it for you or you can host it yourself. And it sounds pretty exciting. So I'm really looking forward to bringing them on to have kind of an update. It's pretty rare that we want to bring a project back, but they've made so much change from what they were able to talk about. It's more than just the free switch-based thing that they had originally. It's now the full end-to-end PBX system, either hosting in the clouds or hosting on your own system. So really want to make sure they come in there. Again, lots of email flying, trying to book the shows here. When we book a show, I publicize it. You can go to our website at twit.tv/floss and see the spreadsheet of all of our upcoming guests or potential upcoming guests and exactly what the schedule is. You can follow us on Floss Weekly on Google+. That's I post when I book a new guest or when I have questions about Floss, I post it there on Google+. We also have Floss Weekly, all one word, as our Twitter and Identica handles. We're now taping at our new time. So if you, if you're a live viewer and you probably missed this show because we're going to be done by the time you get here, we're now at 8:30 a.m. Pacific time, which is America/Los Angeles in the big Olson catalog. So we have a chat room going by. You heard a couple times today. We took questions from the chat room. That's at live.twit.tv. You can watch the show and also chat with us. You follow me personally at Merlyn, M-E-R-L-Y-N, or my full name, Randall L. Schwartz, on Google+. I try to post 5 or 6 interesting things a day there, so people have been quite entertained by some of the things I've been posting there. I'm going to be in Porto Alegre right after OSCON. So I'm going to be at OSCON next week, and I'm going to be in Porto Alegre for FISLE, July 25th to 28th. So if you're going to that open source conference down there, be sure you come up and say hi. I'm going to be in Rio the following week to meet with the Rio Pearl Mongers group and also just to kind of hang out by Copacabana Beach, because as long as I've paid for a trip all the way to Brazil, I'm going to take advantage of it. And then in Atlanta from August 30th to September 3rd, I'm going to be at DragonCon, my traditional indulgence conference where I just go, and because it's just a really wacky place to go. I'm on the EFF track there. I'm doing Hacker 101 and 201. I'm actually giving a short talk on Git, so if you want one more presentation of how I do that there, I'm doing that at Fizzly too as well. And I'm on a special panel that I'm not allowed to announce yet, but let's just say one of the leaders in computer security is going to be sitting right next to me on a panel. I'm really excited about that, so more about that as we get closer to that. That's enough plugging for today. Aaron, what do we want to know about you?
I'll keep it short and sweet. Just go to Google+ and add me to your circles if you want to find out what I'm doing and other Twitch shows that I'm on. I mentioned I was on All About Android last night and ended up being on NSFW as well. So, if you want to see more of me, definitely go to Google+, add me to your circles, and I'll be posting the shows that I'm on. So follow all the cool things that I'm doing there.
Very good, Aaron. Very good. And as always, thank you for getting up an extra hour earlier and coming in to host the show. Well, you didn't go very far. I think you're in your home office, I guess.
Yeah, I'm just in my office today. It was a lot easier just to hang out here. When school starts back up and I have to bring the kids to school, then I can make it over to the brick house early. But for now, I just decided it was better to sleep in a little bit.
I can totally agree with that. I sort of could have used another hour of sleep from last night as well. But I'll get used to this new schedule. It'll be fine. We'll make it work. All right. Well, thank you once again for co-hosting and for answering the questions that you ask, because it always contributes to the show.
You bet. Anytime.
So with that, I'll say, as I say at the end of every show, we'll see you again next time on Floss Weekly.